Ladies and gentlemen, the Golfers Show is here. Kia ora, which means hello, and te reo Māori, which is a New Zealand greeting. Kia ora, welcome. We are a show that covers the game of golf from all angles. Today's episode is great, and we're so happy that we have contact with this man. His name is Sam Pinfold. He is one of the top caddies in the world. Seriously, he's the caddy for Cameron Smith. He's got a fascinating journey, and I say fascinating a lot, don't I? An interesting journey, a compelling journey, and he's a Kiwi. So let's get into it. Sam Pinfold, ladies and gentlemen. How are you, sir?
Very good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, really good. So yeah, we've already made contact. I'm Andy, and we've got Michael Morris. Michael, Sam, Michael.
Hey, Sam.
G'day, mate. How are you?
Good, mate. Really appreciate you coming on today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolute pleasure.
All good. All good. Well, we'll just rock straight into it, eh, and see where we go.
Yeah, sure.
Cool. So, Sam Pinfold, do we have you in Tauranga there?
I am in Tauranga at the moment, yes, mate.
Man, you are kind of like a quiet assassin in the golf industry in New Zealand, aren't you? You're flying all around the world, caddying for top players. How long have you been doing this?
Caddying, that's an interesting way to put it, mate. Caddying, I've been going 13-odd years. I started with Brad Isles in 2008.
Okay. Yep. And can we go through that journey? How have you got? Where did you go from Brad Isles, and how did that all happen?
Well, Brad Isles, we just grew up playing together. I think, you know, Brad's podcast the other day sort of explained a fair bit of it. Grew up playing together in sort of the Wellington region, the Manor Park and the Interclub teams and things like that. And then I moved to Australia and was actually working at Royal Pines Golf Resort, sort of had to sort of just a driving range, cart boy, sort of marshal type job at the resort there. It was pretty good fun, actually, living with a bunch of Kiwis in Surfers Paradise. Mm. And then Isles-y asked me to caddy, and I intended on going over for about sort of, 2, 3, 4 months and just seeing the States and caddying for a bit and then going back to my normal job at the end of the year. And here I am still going 13 years later. So it's been a bit of a journey.
So you went over very socially, and at what point did you realize you're really into this?
I enjoyed the travel. Enjoyed America, enjoyed sort of still being involved in golf at the top level. And then obviously we had a couple of pretty close years to getting onto tour with Brad. And then the one no good year, what was that, would have been 2011. And then when Brad finished up, I sort of had the option of I was sort of tossing and turning myself whether to go back and work for another player. And then I started working for Aaron Price on the Nationwide Tour. So I did about just over a full year with him. And then sort of tried to chase bags on the main tour and sort of worked for a bunch of different people over the next sort of year, 18 months. Yeah, so it was sort of a bit of a journey from there.
So when you say a few other people, I mean, wasn't it Ishikawa and Trevor Immelman? Weren't those a couple of the names?
I worked for Trevor for about 15 or 16 months before I started with Cam. So that was, we didn't have much success together, but Trevor really taught me a lot. He was a very professional fella, and I mean, he's still a very close friend, and he was involved in the President's Cup recently, which was awesome. And he was just a very professional guy with his structure of his days and how he went about things. And I was lucky enough to get to go to a Masters with him. And I mean, he treated me like I was one of his kids going along to the Masters for the first time. And he was showing me this and showing me that. And my first experience around Augusta was on the Sunday afternoon before the tournament, where we played 18 holes with Gary Player. And Gary Player was just like barking and stories and all sorts of things. And 64, I hit it here, and then Arnie hit it here, and this and that. So it was a pretty awesome first experience of Augusta.
So you caddied for Trevor. This is post his Masters win. Forgive me, I can't quite remember what year that was.
Caddy for Trevor would have been probably most of 2015.
Okay.
Yep.
And when caddying for someone comes to an end, yep, is that a strange awkwardness, or is that kind of just standard in your work?
I haven't really had to come across it too often, because I mean, a lot of the jobs that I had in between sort of Aaron Price and sort of Trevor were just jobs where it was on the basis of filling in for 3 or 4 weeks, or 1 week here, 1 week there. And that's how a lot of the stuff with Ishikawa was. It was just through a friend of mine, Simon, who didn't want to spend too long in the States. He had a family in Melbourne, so he'd go back and forward. So I just little filling jobs like that. With Trevor, he was sort of getting to the end of his status and that sort of thing. And then that was when the opportunity with Cameron came up, and he was sort of more than, he was almost pushing me into trying to find jobs with younger players and things like that. So he was well accommodating to that, which was nice.
So Sam, how does it work? So do you guys have like an agent, or is there like an app like Tinder for caddies to hook up with new players? How does that work, mate?
Nah, it's just all word of mouth and reputation, basically. And these days, the agents are having more, the players' agents are having more and more to do with it. Pretty lucky with the agents that Cam's with, the same agent as Mark Leishman and Jason Day. And sort of it's all sort of one little family there with working under Bud Martin. And he sort of looks after us in different ways that he can help with the caddies as well. But it's he's certainly working for the players, but just if he can help us out with either a hotel room here or a flight there or things like that, he certainly helps us out a little bit. So that's nice.
So the agent approaches you and you're like, yeah, I'm interested in caddying for this person. And then what's that journey like?
It's everyone's different with the way that works. The way it worked with Cam is I was actually at the New Zealand Open. I was having some visa issues with the United States in early 2014. And I went down to caddy the New Zealand Open for Michael Sim. And we caddied the first, I'd known Michael Sim for quite a long time, and I caddied the first two rounds with him. We actually played our practice rounds with Cameron. And Cam, at the time, had just turned pro, was just getting started. I think he was 20 years old. And he had just had a local guy from Millbrook, I think, caddying for him, who didn't do the practice rounds. And I think he turned up late on the Friday. And anyway, Cam made the cut, and Michael Sim missed it. And on the Friday night, I was actually having a few beers in one of James Ace's bars, or Bradley Isles probably. And the agent called me and said, would you like to come and caddy for Cameron on the weekend? And I said, oh, why not? And I went along and caddied for him. And the first day, he hit all 18 greens around the hills and shot 66, I think, and he could have shot a lot lower. And I think it was the first, I mean, he was clearly a good player and had a lot of, you know, success as an amateur, but I don't think he'd ever sort of had a caddy before. I mean, I would not call myself Superman or anything, but just did a couple of basic things. And he was just sort of looking at me a bit funny, like, oh, didn't realize that, or you know, didn't understand that. And all of a sudden, so that's how the seed was planted with Cam. And then he broke through at the 2015 US Open at Chambers Bay there. Then straight after that, the agent called me and said, Cam's going to be full-time on the tour. Would you like the job? And a no-brainer. So yes, took the job straight away.
Wow, that is so cool. So it's all by chance.
It is a lot by chance, and it's just a lot by sort of reputation, and sort of there's a lot of, in the States these days, a lot of the young guys coming out, especially the US guys, are bringing like a friend from college or another player they grew up with or a brother. And but then again, there's the sort of the other end of the coin where you've just got a lot of the old school guys that have been out there 10, 20, 30 years and just sort of got the reputations from caddying for good players that sort of, you know, a young guy coming out there might sort of see that they want someone like that rather than a friend. So it's all a matter of personal preference to the player.
Mm. And we don't want to dive too much into the numbers because it's a question that's kind of a strange one to ask, but yep. Is there kind of a negotiated rate, or is the rate that you receive to fund your life, is that standard across the board? How does that work?
No, it's very much negotiated. I mean, been lucky enough that, I mean, it's all done on a weekly retainer per tournament, and that sort of covers, well and truly covers all your flight, transport, your rental car, your a hotel and your food for the week, and it well and truly covers that. And then there's a percentage of prize money, which is, again, negotiated. It's generally around sort of 10% for a win, 7% or 8% for a top 10, and then some guys are on 5% of any other money, some guys are on 8% across the board. I mean, it's all very different. And to tell you the truth, I wouldn't know. I mean, two of my best mates, a lot of best mates, I wouldn't really know what they get paid. You know, it's sort of just a hidden thing between the player and the caddy, and everyone sort of is happy on their own way, I guess.
Mm, well, I mean, you'd want that, wouldn't you? You know, people, it's all different for everyone.
Yeah.
So if you may not be able to comment here, but you know that issue that was in Mexico with Matt Kuchar, was it last year, a year before, and there was, you know, a big blowout talking about how much he paid his caddy and all that sort of stuff. Do you have a view on that? Because I don't always respond immediately to what the media is telling me. I feel like there's some of that we may have missed. What was actually going on there?
Well, I mean, I don't want to comment too much. I don't really know the nitty gritty of it. But I mean, normally you'd want to have it. I mean, and that was sort of, I went through that a bit with guys when you're just doing 1 week something. You need to have it set in stone from the start of the week, A, what you're getting paid and your percentage, because there's no point just sort of taking you do it and then a situation like that comes along and it hasn't been talked about the pay. So I'm not sure if that was a factor in it, but I mean, yeah, it's an interesting one. I think you definitely need to have it pre-arranged, and the way that all shook out, I think, was pretty poorly handled on a few people's parts there. So I don't want to comment too much on it.
Yeah, sure. We don't want to throw you under the bus. Yeah. Although we would love a hot scoop, but no.
Yeah.
And how much of your role, Sam, how much of your role is as a bodyguard sometimes? I mean, obviously there's been stuff in the last couple of years that have come up with caddies being in the news for sometimes in the wrong reason. How much in this modern era with overexcited fans do you have to be a bit of a bodyguard out there?
Especially more, not, I wouldn't say bodyguard, more sort of just marshalling like sort of the crowd and making sure they're staying still and keeping quiet. And then when you can get to certain events or certain situations, especially if you're sort of playing those league groups on the weekend, that becomes a lot more of a factor. The tournaments in the States, I mean, they get a lot of people along there, and a lot of times it's pretty warm weather and they tend to drink a lot of beers, and I mean, it can get pretty rowdy at certain tournaments. But Cam's pretty good with that. He sort of doesn't mind. I mean, Phoenix is a classic example with the crowds like that. It's you're almost better not to try and get him to be quiet and just sort of roll with the noise, because it's not too bad when there's a bunch of noise. It's just, and it's sort of one-off person. It's more just sort of crowd control and sort of keeping an eye on what's going around, especially when he's over the ball and he's not watching. So just got to keep on top of that stuff for him.
Have you ever, what's some of the examples of heckling that you have been a part of?
We had a guy at the PGA Championship, Australian PGA Championship, first one Cam won. So that would have been 2017. And we were on the last hole and we were tied or one in front. I think we were tied with Jordan Zunick. And Cam was in the middle of the fairway and he was over the ball. And when we first got up to the ball, there was a one guy and he's on the other side of the ropes to most of the crowd and other side of the fairway. And he walked up, and as soon as we got to the ball, he said, "Don't choke." And so we both sort of looked over at him, and then Cam was walking into the ball the first time, and the guy just sort of did this big cough, and I looked straight at him. I knew who it was, and I sort of like said, "Hey, mate, quiet again." And then Cam went to walk into the ball again, and he did it again, clearly, obviously trying to put him off. So we had a security guard with us inside the ropes, and I just sort of stopped Cam, pulled him off, and said, "Mate, this guy's got to go." And the guy's actually pretty lucky because Cam obviously grew up about 45 minutes from the PGA Championship course here on the Gold Coast, and he had half of his home course there, and his dad and all his family. And if this bloke was on the other side of the fairway, I'm not sure he would have been able to lead the course with both legs. But either way, he was lucky he was on that side of the fairway. But yeah, it was a pretty interesting way. But obviously worked out right, so we won the tournament in the end. But yeah, I mean, it's not too often. The bigger names in the States, and then if guys sort of do things on, you know, to get the crowd off the wrong side, a la like a Patrick Reed or something like that, then you're doing yourself no favours, because the crowd tends to be pretty hostile in certain places.
Oh, yeah, that Aussie crowd during the President's Cup with Patrick Reed, that was fascinating.
That was awesome.
Do you have a view on that whole situation?
Not really, mate. Again, I'm not going to comment too much on it, especially, I mean, enough's been said by everything. It's just pretty disappointing when golf sort of, you know, it's got so many, you know, good gentlemen and characters and sort of the game of honesty and that sort of stuff, that to have something like that at the top level is just, I mean, it just should never ever happen in the first place. It shouldn't even become an issue, and then for it to become the issue that it does, just pretty disappointing. But I mean, for it to happen the week before the President's Cup, as the international side, you couldn't really ask for a bunch of better timing for it, could you?
Yeah,
I mean, that was my first President's Cup, and I mean, to be involved in crowds like that when they're so, you know, on your side, was it, as the week went on, it was an awesome experience to be involved in. And just, I mean, it would have been so much nicer if we could have pulled that off. I think some of the boys might still be partying, but it was a great week. It was a great week. So I was certainly added a bit more spice to it with what happened just a couple of days, the week earlier. So it was very interesting.
Yeah. I was standing on the edge of the 17th green there when Cameron beat Justin Thomas. And at this point, I was unaware, Sam, that you were the man on his bag. I was just praying to baby Jesus that Cam would beat Justin Thomas, because Justin just looked like a spoiled little shit out there. Yeah. And then Cameron, I love it. I hope I can find this on YouTube somewhere. But when he hold that putt, first of all, did you give him that read?
No, I didn't. I don't tend to read too many putts. He's pretty good on the greens.
Okay. Well, when he rolled that in, it was about 5-6 feet, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was about 6 foot, 7 foot uphill, yeah.
Yeah, and when he rolled it in, and you could see he was just so happy, and the Aussies were going absolutely batshit, just loving it. And then he turned and saw Justin Thomas there, and you tell him to sort of straighten up and just hold himself together.
I mean, it was a pretty emotional day for us. It was only walking off the 7th tee that we saw that we could only get a draw. So up until that point, we still thought we could win the President's Cup. And then walking off the 7th tee, we saw a scoreboard with the fact that we could only get, was it the 15 points for a draw, which we didn't quite get anyway. But he was still pretty fired up, because Ernie drove past us in the fairway and said, a draw is still better than a loss, you know, trying to keep him going. And then I think Cam's just got a lot of pride and just a very sort of proud fellow to get a win like that in Australia in the first President's Cup over one of the, you know, probably the, one of the form players of the US team or the world, really, is a pretty cool thing. And those guys have played each other since amateur golf when they were kids. So just a bit of rivalry and a bit of sort of you know, a pretty good scalp for Cam to knock off there. It was pretty good fun to be a part of.
When we think of a traditional golfer, you know, we think of like, I don't know, maybe tell me if I'm wrong here, Sam, but I think of someone like Brad Faxon, you know, think of some lanky American gentleman, and then you see Cam there walking around with his flat peak with this great Aussie accent. There's something about him that is just so relatable. He seems like the everyman. And does he find himself have a bit of an imposter syndrome to some extent? Because, you know, he just looks like an everyman walking around there.
I think it's just, his old man's a great fella. I think the one team where he grew up, the country, like the little course is just, I mean, it's nothing fancy. It's a great little course. But, I mean, I think just his upbringing and his just, I mean, he's just never changed since the day I met him, really. He's just the same old kid. And, I mean, he's just really good at golf. And he spends a lot of time hanging out with, funny enough, us caddies on tour. He sort of eats in the caddy area a lot and hangs out with us. And he's just a good fella, mate, and just sort of good upbringing, good people around him. And, yeah, so he's just good fun to be around, which, I mean, makes him sort of, you know, even more relatable on the course. And, I mean, we have our moments on the course, but it's generally pretty quick and we can sort of, you know, balance out and get back going together. So it's all good. Everyone has them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we see a lot of mind games sometimes on the tour between players, but do caddies have a bit of a playbook in terms of how to maybe, you know, get one up on another caddy or do anything in terms of where you put the bag to put somebody else off and that sort of thing?
It's generally pretty friendly out there amongst the caddies. It tends to, I mean, and you will help each other out and do little things for each other with regard to finding the next day's pin position and things like that. But sort of late on a Sunday afternoon, or if you, especially in any of the final groups on Sunday, it generally gets pretty quiet amongst the players and the fellow caddies in the group. There's generally not much conversation. Yet if you're teeing off at, 15 shots out of the lead on a Sunday morning in 55th place, you'll probably find you have a pretty good day out there with the other player in the group and the caddy. It's just all, you know, there's a lot of conversation, a few jokes and things like that being said. You flip that around 3 or 4 hours later and your second or third group, second or third last group, there's not many jokes being said and it's all pretty professional and kept to each other. So it's certainly different in the different situations.
And say if you're playing with a player who hits it similar to Cam, can you give an example of a player who may have a similar game or length of the tee, all that sort of stuff?
I mean, not really. You tend to sort of just take a little bit of notice on what clubs have been at.
You knew where I was going with this, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, you do have a look what players are hitting off par threes, but it's not the be-all and end-all because at the end of the day, you don't really know exactly how far they hit their club or how they hit it themselves. It's just a little bit of indication. But, you have little looks at certain things. So,
can you give us a map out of what a... Let's say it's Thursday, round one, and you're playing the Phoenix Open.
Yeah.
What does your day look like? When does it start? When does your tournament start as a caddy in that week?
In the week, I tend to try to beat Cam to every venue if possible to get a walk around the courses, either on the Monday morning. There's generally a program on the Monday afternoon, which we're not involved in. So you sort of try and walk the course once on either Monday afternoon or a Tuesday morning. So Monday morning or Tuesday morning, depending on the tournament and the course. If Cam's played it before and win the Pro-Am, we might only play 9 holes on a Tuesday and then play the full Pro-Am on the Wednesday and then sort of go time on the Thursday. So it's very... Very, I mean, if we've never been to a course before or have struggled there, or if he's coming off a week off, we might do a bit more work. Or if we're in the middle of a 4 or 5 week stretch, it's sort of, you know, a lot quieter on the Monday, Tuesdays and Wednesdays. But I definitely get fully around the course without him and just the book and sort of just double check the book and see how we played it either the previous year or work out how we're going to play it this year. And then sort of once with him and then we sort of go. So it's not too heavy, but weeks like majors, especially like Augusta or US Opens and that, when it's at a new course, we'll get there on a Sunday morning and then have an extra sort of day down half preparation than normal.
Okay, so then it's Thursday tee off time. Let's say teeing off at 8 o'clock in the morning. What time are you getting there? And then and what does that look like, that lead up to tee off?
I'm getting there about probably just before 6, and then we try to get there at least 2 hours before. We can get the pin positions for the next day, the night before. They come out about 9 o'clock on an online platform for us, so we can put them into our yardage book. I'll get the bag, sort of sort the bag out, make sure we've got the right amount of balls and gloves or whatever for the day, and then sort of Cam will come out about an hour and 20 before the tee time, and we'll sort of have a bit of a chat, and he'll mark up the balls with the Sharpie and sort of that sort of thing, and he's already done a lot of sort of pre-body warm-up stuff, and then we sort of go from the putting green to the driving range to the chipping green and then another quick putt, and then it's tee off time.
And you see, he's about to tee off the first. What sort of conversations do you have?
Like a Thursday morning, it's all kept pretty simple and pretty relaxed and just sort of going through the plans and, you know, trying to do anything silly and just stick to what, you know, the way you planned it. And just the more conversation regarding the shot, the better. And then the more you can switch them off during the round, especially if they're playing well, and start talking about, I mean, cars is a big one with Cam. He loves his cars. So we didn't chat about them a lot. So, yeah, just things like that. So, and then sort of work your way through the day. And if he needs a bit of a rev up after four or five holes, he's struggling, it looks like he's thing, I'll give him that. Or if he's playing really well, I'll tend to get the bag and get out of the way a little bit quicker than normal and let him go. So just sort of read your man and see how he's going.
Oh, wow. So when do you know it's time to back off with Cameron Smith, when it's time for Sam Pinfold just to step out of the way?
I can tell it pretty early on some days, just when he's, you know, the irons are firing straight at the flags and it's all pretty simple and he's, you know, not sort of questioning too many things about the wind or the conditions or distances, and he's just pretty happy and pretty comfortable. And then sort of, you know, you see him make a couple of birdies in a row and hit a couple of good shots, and then, you know, it's pretty much time just to give the number and the front, all right, where we landed this, all right, wind off the left, and then just jump out of the way and let him go. So he's pretty good.
Have you ever, I'm sure you have, sorry for this question, you probably don't want to discuss it, but you've ever made just absolute shocker calls? Can you tell us some examples of those?
Oh, yeah, I think every caddy has. I mean, it's nothing that springs to mind too, like that's cost a tournament or anything like that, but yeah, it's certain, I mean, and a lot of them do with Mother Nature. You tell them the wind's off the left or something, or into the wind, and then, and all of a sudden, they just get a little bit of a puff downwind and the ball flies 20 metres further than it should have. Caught myself a couple of times with the wrong number, but I've always managed to correct that before he's hit the ball. So, yeah, I mean, it happens. It happens. But nah, nothing too major that's cost us a tournament or anything like that.
I've heard some things that a lot of players really lean on their caddies, where they basically hold their caddies responsible for everything. Yeah. Don't want to mention any, but Jordan Spieth is one of them that I've heard.
At the end of the day, it's a team, and we're there trying to do the best for each other. No one's trying to one up each other and, you know, put the other one in the crap or anything. But I mean, it's I guess it's just the fact that we're the only ones out there. You know, it's a very, I mean, those guys, I know, a lot of pressure out there, and we're the ones by their side that you know, if something does go wrong, that we're maybe the first ones they stare at, whether it's our fault or not. Or I mean, but at the end of the day, we're only trying to provide the best advice we can. And sometimes it's wrong, sometimes it's right. Sometimes they hit it perfect, sometimes they don't. I mean, sometimes you get a bad bounce and somehow that's the caddy's fault. But I mean, it's just the result of the high pressure environment and the boys are under. And so it's fun to be there by the side when it's going great. It's also sometimes pretty tough to be there when it's not going your way. So either way, you can't take the, you know, all the good and not take the bad. So you got to have a bit of both.
It must be real fun now, though, because, you know, Cam, I'm sure he's financially secure. He's really proved himself as a pro. And, you know, there's not that sort of course, you're still grinding and wanting to achieve, but there isn't that threat necessarily. Is that somewhere close to true?
I think there's certain levels where I know what you're talking about, where, I mean, if you're grinding away trying to keep a card on a main tour, it's very tough. And then you sort of see that these other guys, you know, up the top or end, or Cam knows, you know, like saying he's got that win under his belt this year and the status is all secure for a couple of years. But I mean, I think for him, then the goals just shift higher and the expectations become more and more. So, and now it's becoming contending in the bigger events and contending more regularly. So I don't think it ever relaxes. I mean, it does relax to a certain point a bit, but I think the goals just shift and the goalpost just gets, you know, higher and higher. So it's the pressure's always there.
How many balls do they take out and how often do they change the ball? That's always I've heard talk of like a different ball a hole.
Not that many. We start each day with nine.
Okay. And nine. Is that, you know, you're not expected to lose any of those?
Oh, mate, who knows? Yeah. We've never run out, I'll tell you that. We've never been close to running out, I don't think so. No, we start each day with nine and just go from there. So it tends to be enough every time.
And who's your mentor?
I've been pretty lucky enough. Matty Kelly and Joe Scovran, who Matty caddies for Mark Leishman and Joe caddies for Ricky Fowler. They were the first year I went caddying in 2008. Matty's from Australia but now lives in Florida, and Joe's from America. And I met them my first year out there, and Matty was obviously caddying for Leish then. Joe wasn't. He was caddying for Brendan Steele. But just became mates with them, and, I mean, we're pretty much inseparable on tour. If we're either staying in an Airbnb all together or in a couple of hotels, we're always together, us three. I mean, I've been lucky enough. They had obviously a lot of success a lot earlier than I did, and just sort of learning from them and the way they dealt with it and they'd sort of progressed on with their careers and sort of their lives, and sort of they've helped me out a lot. So I'm pretty owe a lot to both of them, and they're still, you know, extremely good mates. So it's nice to have that, and guys you trust and rely on when you're out on tour. Makes a big difference.
And is it true that Kiwis are overrepresented on the bags. Like, what? Why do Kiwis make such good caddies?
I'm not sure. There's actually New Zealanders and Australians. There's a lot of Australian caddies out there too. I'm not sure. I'm not sure why that is. I guess Steve sort of maybe paved the way for us a bit. Had a fair bit to do with Steve the last three or four years, which has been nice. But yeah, I mean, I'm not sure why it makes a thing. But yeah, there's certainly a lot of Kiwis and Australians out there.
Yeah, what makes Steve so great? Why is he the GOAT?
Well, he's obviously good at what he does, but extremely good at what he does. He worked for some great players. And I mean, the one thing I've heard a lot is what makes a good caddy, and that's a great player. But yeah. I mean, not taking away from Steve, I think I've seen him work, and he's very, very professional, and he has sort of quite high expectations, and I think working with the players that he worked for and developing that sort of mental side of it for himself, I think is sort of, that's sort of, you can see that in the way he caddies and just very confident, walks confidently, talks confidently. I've been with him in certain groups and he's very adamant when he calls clubs. He's very confident. I think that gives a player a lot of confidence and a lot of sort of, you know, sort of belief in themselves. If the caddy believes in them that strong and is that confident, then the player sort of stands up thinking he's Superman, which I think Steve's very good at doing to players.
Mm, and where to next for you then? What's the next few years look like?
Keep going with Cam. I've got we've got a June 11 start date back, I think. I'm not sure if that's going to go ahead, but we are planning on playing the first four events if they do go ahead. But we'll have a busy sort of 3 or 4 months through June, September. And then I think we've got a major in October and then the Masters in November. So it's certainly going to be a different end to this year. I go back and forth to New Zealand a lot. I tend to not spend too much time in the States anymore. I've got a very loving and understanding partner here in New Zealand who sort of understands what I do and the time away. So I'm very grateful for her. But I love coming home to her and I love being home in New Zealand. So,
she's in the room with you, isn't she, Sam?
No, she's not in the room with me. She's not in the room with me. I'd love the States for the caddying for the tournaments, but I really don't want to live there. And I like to sort of have a base in New Zealand, which Steve sort of showed was possible. It makes it a lot easier working for a higher level player whose schedule is planned out well in advance. That couldn't really do this if you're working for a player who didn't really know where to play in the next couple of months and sort of struggling money wise. So that helps. So I'm sort of taking advantage of that. But yeah, just sort of keep grinding away with Cam. It was nice to get that individual win there at the Sony at the start of the year. But just keep collecting a few more flags. It'd be nice. The flag is generally the caddy's main trophy. They get the flag off the 18th green and the bib. And sort of the more bibs and flags you collect as a caddy, I think sort of nice to hang on the wall at the end of your career and sort of tell a few stories about. It'd be nice.
That's so cool.
Hey, Sam, what do you think of when the tour does restart, this idea that you'll be playing with no crowds? What do you make of that, mate?
I mean, not being in the States, it's hard to put a gate. I don't really get a full gauge on whether they're going to be good to go in June 11 or not. But it's certainly going to be interesting playing without crowds because I think part of that, that's something I didn't think. I've only read it yesterday, I think, in a media thing, that there's probably going to be no grandstands or hospitality because they don't need to build them for no crowds. So it's certainly going to be weird out there. It's one thing being out there early on a weekend round or something when there is almost no crowds, but you've still got all the grandstands and hospitality, everything set up, so it kind of frames the holes and sort of gives you a backstop or certain sort of bailout areas and places. It's certainly going to be interesting playing some of these courses and some of these tournaments with no crowds and then sort of no infrastructure around as well. You know, sort of be like you're just going down your local course on a Saturday, but all of a sudden you've got all the best players in the world there. So it's gonna be quite different and that sort of thing, and just be quite sort of, quite eerie and sort of quite weird. So yeah, certainly kind of interesting. But just and then you know if you're in contention on this late on the Saturday, late on the Sunday, and there's sort of no big crowds following you, or no sort of you're just sort of looking away at scoreboards and no one's clapping or cheering. So it will be certainly very different.
And no doubt, Sam, you've had a Tiger experience. What was yours?
I haven't really.
What?
No, he's the one player that I've never been out in a group with. I think I've been out in a group with every other player in the world, or certainly of the bigger names. Never been paired with Tiger. I don't really even have a Tiger story. A little bit to do with him just there at the President's Cup at the end of last year. We'd just gone back to even with Justin on after the losing the 15th hole, or maybe just back to one up after losing the 15th hole, and he was standing right there on the 16th tee, and Justin smashed a low bullet drive right down the middle, and Tiger was pretty vocal in his support for Justin. And I mean, I guess trying to maybe get under Cam's skin a little, and Cam, to his credit, stepped up and absolutely piped the drive right down the middle. And I mean, if that's not doing under the most pressure that there is, I mean, that's a pretty good example of Cameron Smith for you right there. That the more you throw him up against the wall or put him in trouble, he just sort of fights back and just shows you that he can do it. So I thought that was pretty cool. That sort of stuck with me for a while there.
Wow, that's the ultimate. You couldn't get any worse than that. Yeah. Like, when I say worse, more difficult situation.
Yeah, and I mean, Tiger was standing. I mean, if I stepped back half a foot, I would have stood on his toes. So he was standing right next to Cam in our bag when he was getting up and supporting Justin, which is his job to do as the captain. And, you know, good on the boys hitting great shots. But it was that stuck with me for a while. I walked off that tee and gave Cam a little smile and a wink. So that a boy, you know. Mm. So it's pretty cool when things like that happen.
What do you think, Sam, about the game in general? Because, you know, when Tiger's not around, the game really does suffer. What do we do about that, do you think?
I mean, it does. You can certainly notice the difference when you're at an event when Tiger's there or not. I think it's in pretty good hands. I mean, I think the way, there's certain players now that are very good with the way they deal with the media. I really like the way Rory talks to the media in his press conferences. I think he's super honest, super open. I think the tournaments and stuff are going. I mean, Tiger's just one of those once-in-generation things that, sort of, you know, I mean, we wouldn't be playing for the money we're playing for today if it wasn't for Tiger Woods and what he's done the last 20-odd years, even longer. So I think a lot of the players, I mean, all the players are thankful for Tiger that he's been around. And, I mean, who knows who the next star will be or whether we'll get another player over like that again. I'm sure we will in 10, 20, 30, maybe 40 years' time. Who knows? But, I mean, I think golf's in a good spot. There's a lot of turnover for that number one spot and some pretty good tournament's been played out. So yeah, I mean obviously it's better when Tiger's involved, but he's getting closer to the end of the career, so he's certainly served golf well, and I'm sure he'll continue to give back to it as well.
Great stuff. Hey Sam, look, one quick question from me. What was it like the first time you put on the overalls at Augusta, mate? What does that feel like?
It was pretty cool. That whole week is still, and the one of the bizarre things about that is because you wear the overalls, you walk into Augusta now. We've got a sort of side entrance there off the main road that goes straight to the caddy area, which is unbelievable. It's completely first class, and the way we get treated is unbelievable. But the funny thing is, you walk in like gym shorts and a t-shirt, and you feel extremely bizarre walking into one of the most exclusive, private, most beautiful places in the world, and you're walking in like a dingy old t-shirt and gym shorts. But it is quite weird. But putting the overalls on is it's one of the sort of special things about Augusta, and every time you go back there, sort of the hairs on the back of your neck stand up a little bit, and you know we're someone pretty special, so it's pretty nice.
Awesome.
And this is another strange question, but is Augusta, do the pros see that as really a hard course compared to all the others they play?
Yes, yeah, they do. The green complex is there, unless you've been there and seen the slopes of the greens, and I mean, even the elevation change in the fairways, it is a tough course, very tough course. And I mean, I that's why you sort of go back to, they've talked about all these, the lengthening of courses, and the courses are too short. I mean, Augusta's got two of the greatest par fives in the world on the back nine there on 13 and 15. And they just, it's a classic par five. If you hit a great drive down there, most of these guys, even Cam, I think at one stage he hit a 6-iron into 15 and maybe a 6-iron into 13 at some stage as well, which is, you know, a mid-iron, which you and say in theory that pros shouldn't hit into par fives. But he's standing there with that 6-iron, and he knows unless he hits that absolutely perfect, he's in the water or he's in trouble. And, I mean, that's the beauty of those holes, that it doesn't matter. And, I mean, if you hit a bad drive down there, you've got a wedge, you know, you lay up, and the wedge shot's just as scary as it is with the 6-iron. It's even worse if you get in one of those bad slopes or downhill slopes. So I think they're just great par fives, and it's just a great course in that. And I don't really support all this talk about winding back the ball or lengthening courses. It's not the answer. So it's not the way to do it.
Could you get off the fence there, please, Sam? Really nice to have your opinion. And we'll wrap up with a little test. If I just go through Cameron's bag, could you just tell us how long he hits each of these clubs?
Okay, in metres?
Yes, metres, please.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, so 3-iron.
3-iron, well, that goes in and out of the bag with the 5-wood, but the 3-iron will go sort of 213 metres.
Okay, 4-iron?
201.
5?
5, got 192.
6?
6 is going to go 178.
Oh, wow, that's quite a long 6-iron. Yeah, okay. 7-iron?
164.
8?
150.
Nine.
1-4. I won 39, 140.
How do you get 139 as a number?
The technology they use in the TrackMan in these days, I mean, we warm up with it most days, and it's extremely consistent. And Cam's distance control is one of his strengths. So, yeah, it's funny as it sounds. And you do little things to squeeze an extra meter or two out of it here and there. It's very interesting when you talk to people about it, and then they sort of just don't really get the general gist of how good these guys are with the control.
Are you talking to him in meters or yards, mate?
He's grown up. We're meters.
Yeah.
We stick with meters. And these days, more often than not, can get a yardage book of a meters book in the States with the yardage books. The yardage books they give us for the tournaments these days are unbelievable with the detail and the information in them. And you talk to some of the guys that have been out there 30 or 40 years, the older fellas, and they still talk about having to use the old fishing line and to work out how far it was across water and get out there with that old wheel and sort of mark things off with spray paint on trees. So it's certainly changed a lot, and I'm glad that we have the benefit of the technology we do these days.
But do you back that up with a GPS, mate? Do you go out there with a rangefinder or something?
We've got like a rangefinder, and we'll use that a lot when we're walking the course, or use that to like maybe get some distances and not in the book if we want to lay up to a certain position or things like that. But these days, the books are very thorough.
We've still got a few clubs to go through. The pitching wedge, what is the low end of a pitching wedge? Let's say he just takes a little off it, and then the top end if he has to really wind a pitching wedge.
I mean, if he hits a pretty hard wedge with a draw, he can get it out there close to that 139, 140 number as the 9-iron.
Jesus.
The stock 40, it's a 46 degree pitching wedge, and the stock one of them is about sort of 128, 130.
Okay. And what wedges does he rotate?
He carries four wedges, 46, 52, 56, and a 60. And we have about three different versions of the 60-degree wedge with different bounce on them depending on the turf that week. So, and that's Cameron Smith's bread and butter. I mean, those wedges, his short game and his hit from inside 120 metres, he's world class. And if he's not the best, he's right up there with being one of the best. So I leave him alone with a lot of that stuff, and he just sort of works his way through his mind with the bounce and spin and that sort of stuff, especially with those distances from, and we don't talk too much about shots from inside of sort of 100 metres, that he's just sort of like a bit of an artist and a genius with that sort of stuff. And I'll give him the number and sort of we'll talk about which way it's going to spin or if it's going to, which way it bounce type thing. And other than that, he'll draw it up in his head, and he's pretty much a genius with that sort of stuff.
That's so amazing. We were watching Tiger on the range at Melbourne, and seeing everyone hit shots, everyone's either hitting a draw or a fade with their, long irons and drivers and three woods and all that sort of stuff. But Tiger was hitting like these low hooks with wedges for 70 yards.
Yeah.
Like that's what's actually going on. Are these guys hitting that sort of fade spin and hook spin in pitch shots?
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, some guys more than others, some guys who've got far better hands. And I think another Australian, Mark Leishman, if you watch him with a wedge from inside 100 metres, he's another one. And especially out of the bunker, Leishman, a lot of the Aussies are good out of the bunker, actually, but Mark Leishman with his, he drives these low wedges in, and it looks like the ball's going to go 20, 30 yards past the pin, and it just stops on a dime. Like, it just spins perfectly next to the hole. And every time I've seen him do it, you just shake your head, and he's just tapping the divot back down. It's just standard for him. But it's pretty impressive to watch that sort of stuff. And when you get to know guys' games, I've got to know Leishman pretty well, being so close with him and Maddie, and just seeing how certain guys do certain things well, it's pretty impressive. And other players notice that too. They'll sort of stand back and know when they're seeing something that, either they can't do or they certainly haven't perfected where another guy has, and they'll admire it and sort of give a little clap and a little acknowledgement where it's due.
We feel like we could talk to you forever. I'll get my wrap-up in a second, but a couple more questions. if the most impressive long game that you've ever witnessed?
Rory McIlroy with driver.
Okay.
And that's another world.
Yeah. Is he hitting it 30, 40 metres past everyone else?
Yeah. I mean, not everyone else. And it's not all the time. I mean, we drew with him and Ricky the first two rounds of Augusta last year. And the two drives that he hit on 13 in the first two rounds, I mean, are just an absolute joke. That's a shot that, I don't know, Cam hasn't got that shot. I mean, it's a 340-yard bomb draw up over trees over all the trouble, and it's just, I mean, it's, the second he hits it, it's just like, wow, that's impressive. Yet I think he made par and bogey the two times he did it. So, again, it just shows you that it's not everything. It's a super impressive, but, yeah, it doesn't mean he gets the ball in the hole guaranteed every time.
So long games, Rory. Mid-irons?
Mid-irons for Adam Scott.
And then it sounds like Cam's the top dog from anything from 130 in.
Yeah, I'll back him with anyone 130 in, especially with the lob wedge in hand. He's pretty good around the greens, the old lob wedge.
And the best putting in your eyes?
Ooh, Cam's another very good putter. I'm gonna back my horse here and say Cam.
Awesome. Oh, Sam, thank you so much for your time. This is cool, man. We really appreciate this. This is an insight that I don't think many people ever get to listen to. So thank you very much. You're a top man and all the very best.
Thank you very much, Matt. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam. Really appreciate it.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Awesome. See you, buddy.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, Michael, if you didn't realize, I was really into that. That was cool. To get that insight, I just love it because, to hit a pitching wedge 139 meters, when you're going after it, oh, man, that's – and with control, you could slog one that far if you go real hard, but to have that with the control just gives you like a – it just shows just how damn good these guys are. That was great. As we say with the Golfers Show, we like to try and cover all angles of the game. So – we're going to be, over the next few episodes, talking to the number one speed golfer in the world. He's a Kiwi, Jamie Reid. That's going to be awesome. Can't wait for that. And also, you may have seen her online. She's a Kiwi. Her name's Tania Tade, and she is the trick shot artist. She's had many viral videos. She's cool. We're going to catch up with her from Arizona in the next few episodes. So thank you for listening. All the very best. Look after yourselves. Farewell, and we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.